Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, a podcast for embedded Linux developers.
Hi, this is Gene Sally. I'm here with Maciej Halasz.
Hello.
And we're doing the third in the series of podcasts. We're talking about real-time and real-time in Linux in particular.
It is a very actually interesting topic to our listeners, so yes.
Well, yeah. I know this is number three. I think we could probably do three more. I'm saying we're going to do, but we could probably do three more.
There's probably more material that you can cover.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, last time we talked about things like sources of latency in the kernel, and you know, one of the things, maybe podcast number, I don't know, pick some other number. We can talk about user space latency too, because I know we focus mostly on if you're running device drivers, and you're working on the kernel, how you could avoid getting yourself into situations where you cause latency or other unbounded conditions that'll will screw up your real time system, right? And so, and what we wanted to do in that podcast is touch on what was different in the 2.6 kernel with respect to real time. And well, we ran out of time.
Right, exactly. So last time we started actually talking about how the real time concepts that we covered in a two previous podcasts got implemented in 2.6 kernel, and we simply ran out of time. So just to recap, I would like to actually go through a list of what's new in 2.6 Linux kernels, or which of the concepts that we discussed are presently implemented in the latest 2.6 kernels.
Yeah, that sounds fair. Because I know what we did is we sort of looked at the effects.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But we really didn't dig into the, well, why is it that way and what changed to make it that way. And so, yeah.
All right. So let's go through a list very quickly, and let's just list them out one by one. So beginning with 2.6.0 Linux kernel all the way till 2.6.22.2, I guess, is the latest official release from kernel.org.
Yeah.
We have the O1 scheduler. We have the improved POSIX implementation of signals and other mechanisms in the Linux kernel. We have a number of different levels of preemption. We have voluntary preemption. We have preemptible kernel, and then full real-time preemption. We have...
Oh, you tried to explain that to me last time, right?
Well, and we'll get there, but let's go through the list before we dive into details. But so hard IRQs executed in threat context. We also have in 2.6 Linux kernels a priority inheritance implemented on both kernel space and user space. The newest add-on to Linux kernel that touches upon real-time is the introduction of high-resolution timers in 2.6.21, I believe. And then there are other interesting areas of Linux kernel that make developers' lives easier, developers' lives who try to develop real-time platforms, applications. And I'm thinking here about various configuration options that you can turn on under kernel hacking to monitor the behavior of the Linux kernel.
Oh, cool.
I'm not sure if I covered everything. We might actually find a few other topics as we go through each of them in more detail.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, probably the best place to kick off you want to talk about high-resolution timers, right? Because I know that's what came in last. But that's actually a quite important addition.
Well, so I would actually want to go through a list the way we laid it out. So that, you know, just a bit of, anyways. O1 scheduler, that's, I think, something that we covered in very much detail during both of our previous podcasts, I guess. We talked about why it's called O1 and what's so special about that particular implementation.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk about improved POSIX compliancy.
Sure.
Because as you remember, in 2.4 Linux kernel, the POSIX, the implementation of POSIX API was not the greatest, at least not from developer that relies on certain behavior from, let's say, signals or message queues.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know what they, I know what happened is that the message queues over in this release are, well, are actually implemented, which is really nice. Because I know a lot of folks that are out there, a lot of the customers that I deal with that have decent sized systems rely on message queue for message passing, because it is something that's well, implemented on most POSIX systems. And so it makes it really easy to shuffle data across, especially across process borders, because you can synchronize on a file handle even. Mm-hmm. So it makes it really great. And I know that was simply missing in the other implementation, the POSIX implementation that came with 2.6. And it is because it does cross processes. It is something that does require a lot of work in the kernel in order to get that done. Mm-hmm. I know another thing that was added in too was actual priority inheritance, which was really nice. There's a couple flags in POSIX that you can send in at different points to say, I want to inherit the, if I'm a mutex, set this flag so I priority inherit, or if I'm a process, take the priority of my, whoever spawned me. So, folks that were used to using that, those sort of protocols and other systems are actually able to take advantage of them. I guess one of the neat things about the POSIX is that it is a spec, right?
Right.
And it's one of those things where
you read about it. You think that it's going to do the magic thing for you in your application. You think you understand it. You write your application, and then boom, doesn't do what it's supposed to.
It doesn't
work.
I know a lot of the things in Linux it doesn't. If it doesn't comply, it'll accept all the parameters and just not do anything. And so, which is kind of frustrating because you crack open your yay old POSIX book, and it explains to you what to do, and you set up everything correctly then.
Right.
Well, nothing.
Well, another area that they actually improved in 2.6 Linux kernel around POSIX compliance is an improved implementation of signals.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
In the past, 2.4 kernels, and I think that in early 2.6, you were not able to process as many times as signal arrived. So let's say that signal A arrives to another process 10 times but before it gets processed.
Right? Yeah.
But when that process that receives those signals starts running, it sees only one occurrence of that signal.
Yeah.
From a real-time standpoint, that's very bad because...
Oh, it's worse than bad.
Right. those 10 signals were sent for a particular reason.
Yeah.
And the process that was supposed to handle them was supposed to execute 10 times and not only once, and acknowledge that the signal was processed or received.
Yeah. So that's really cool. Because I know that's one of those bugs, right? That's sort of one of those, I say a bug, but a defect or problem that crops up. Man, that only gets you in the field, and it's really difficult to model that out of your system even. Mm. I mean, you can have that sort of problem crop up if you weren't really aware of how things were handled. And test it on the bench, and then have something go out to a customer, and it'll fall over under some sort of stress condition. And how do you know, right?
Well, exactly, and especially if your application is designed in such a way that only at certain occasions the number of signals that's supposed to be processed are showing any effect on the application, right? So. I've seen applications where the fact that the signals were not implemented correctly were not impacting necessarily the application because the application was not necessarily designed well. So one signal was sufficient to do whatever application wanted to do.
Right? Yeah.
But in scenarios where you, for example, create a platform, you test that platform and you send those 10 signals, you process only one, and you don't test for the overall behavior, then you deliver that to a customer. The customer puts an application on top of it that relies on the POSIX signals and the right queuing of them.
Mm-hmm.
Things start behaving badly, right?
Yeah, it goes boom.
More or less. All right, so Let's jump to the next topic, maybe. The next topic, I'm looking at our short list here of improvements in 2.6 Linux kernel, is levels of preemption. And just to put it out on the table, there are, in Linux kernel, in 2.6 Linux kernel, you can select the level of preemption that you want to enable. Again, the reason behind giving that option to a user is that there is a trade-off between throughput and reliability. And that's again something we covered in the first episode, I guess, on real time.
But it's still worth mentioning. You know, there's you know, real time system is because you don't want to bore yourselves with the other podcast, right? I mean, real time system doesn't mean fast; it means predictable. And in order for you to have a predictable system, you're going to make trade-offs, no doubt about it, between how much you can handle versus how reliably you can handle data. And when you talk about something like preemption, you're tuning your processing's ability to be interrupted by something else of a higher priority.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a different, you know, I look at it sort of the opposite way. But I mean, what you're really saying is that for a certain process, it is much less important than other ones, and you allow it to be preempted.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is, of course, that process won't run as much, which, depending on what that is, could translate to lower throughput. But that's coming at the predictability of some other process.
Right.
I'm sorry, I don't mean
that's actually a very, very great explanation of the concept.
Yeah.
And I wanted to touch upon voluntary preemption first, because last time we did touch upon that topic a bit, and I don't think it was clear enough to us here in our little studio as well.
Well, the thing about it was really clear to you. You couldn't describe it to me. I'm just not smart enough to understand.
Well, so let's try to actually tackle that topic again.
Okay.
Because so a source of confusion last time probably was coming from the fact that we were trying to compare the voluntary preemption with priority inheritance protocol, right? And those are two separate concepts that, well, work together, but not in the same way.
Yeah, and the mistake, my mistake was as I sort of equated them. And yeah.
Well, no, but I think that this is great because those two concepts are confusing. They kind of imply the same concepts, the same behaviors, but they're different.
Right? Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about voluntary preemption. And so that's a first level of preemptiveness that you can enable in a Linux kernel.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out from the fact that the Linux kernel code can preempt itself. And that's how it's supposed to be, right? You want for a real-time operating system to really be real-time and quote-unquote soft real-time in this case.
Mm-hmm.
You want the operating system to be able to schedule high-priority tasks regardless of what else is executing in the system in the shortest time possible, right?
Got it.
So voluntary preemption adds explicit rescheduling points throughout the kernel, and the way that has been accomplished was through hiding behind the calls to another function, which is called might sleep in the Linux
mm-hmm.
kernel.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that function might sleep has already been implemented as a debugging hook throughout the Linux kernel. And when the real-time open source community started looking at the sources of latencies,
mm-hmm.
they came to a conclusion that they can simply reuse those functions. And whenever the might sleep call is being called by the Linux kernel,
mm-hmm.
they simply reroute that call to a cond reschedule.
Yes.
Which allows the scheduler to kick in and see if there is a high priority process ready to run. If there is, well, there's preemption. And the great thing about this approach is that they didn't have to go throughout entire Linux kernel source code
mm-hmm.
and touch all those places where those additional preemption points have been added, right?
Mm-hmm.
They simply reused an already existing function and just
sort of piggybacked on it.
Yeah.
Because what you're really saying there is, you know, in layman's terms, or at least things that I can understand, right, is that at certain points you're going to voluntarily stop and say, okay, what else do you have to do? And that could be in between whenever the scheduler tick would normally happen. Right. And that's how you get much better, much better latency, because mm-hmm. instead of waiting for the scheduler to kick in and interrupt the task, what's happening is this thread is saying, oh, well, I can be interrupted now. So mm-hmm. if you want to, go ahead. And that exactly. sort of, and that sort of granularity goes to reducing latency, because then, and then we talked way back again mm-hmm. about scheduler latency, and we talked about other sources of latency in the system, although I don't think I'd categorize this as scheduler latency. The more often you get to evaluate what you need to run next, the closer you approximate a real-time system.
Right, exactly. And so this concept, the voluntary preemption, does not deal with mutual exclusion.
Okay.
And that's how different it is compared to priority inheritance on mutexes, right? Because priority inheritance on kernel mutexes really deals with getting or unblocking a high priority task in a mutual exclusion or contention on a shared resource.
Simply, okay.
Right. So back to voluntary preemption. Yeah, it adds, I believe, around 100 additional preemption points throughout the kernel.
Okay.
Which brings down the latency to a level of, I believe, milliseconds. But that level of preemption has been added actually on top of another level of preemptiveness, the preemptible kernel, which was whose goal was actually to achieve that level of latency of 1 millisecond. Okay, I see that you're screening your face, so let me rewind and talk about preemptible kernel option inside the Linux kernel. So the concept was here to, again, add additional rescheduling points throughout the kernel, but in a more invasive approach, just to make sure that the Linux kernel can perform a certain activity,
okay.
Like for example, playing audio without any jitter, without any delays, and the goal for that particular action on a Pentium platform, mm-hmm. a fairly fast Pentium platform,
okay.
was to achieve a goal of 1 millisecond latency.
Okay.
And so that patch, that part of a real-time patch, causes most kernel code to be preempted involuntarily at any time.
Okay.
Except kernel critical sections.
Okay.
And as a benefit, applications that are soft real-time but do require a certain level of CPU time mm-hmm. can execute as required, right?
Okay. So
that combined with voluntary preemption ensures certain level of latencies.
Okay. Do we have, yeah. So, I mean, that's a really good thing. Because, you know, you run into these sort of latency issues and they come and get you. So it's, but again, it still is a throughput trade-off, right?
It is, but not that big at this level of preemption.
I see.
There's the next level of preemption, which is called, I believe, full real-time preemption, where goal was to achieve a level of latency of microseconds.
Okay.
Right. And that particular implementation or that part of a real-time patch that got into the Linux kernel mainline mm-hmm. Is more invasive. It causes all but most critical kernel code to be involuntarily preempted.
Okay.
So only few places kernel really cannot be preempted. In all other places, the call to reschedule really does execute.
Okay, instead of just being a stop. Right. Yeah.
And the reason why it was done this way, in my understanding,
okay.
Was that there was well, particularly that trade-off between throughput and reliability.
Sure.
Right. There are applications that are okay with a millisecond latency scale,
mm-hmm.
But do require fairly fast, interrupt communication on a network card, perhaps, mm-hmm. right? And then there's the application where you run certain tasks periodically mm-hmm. in a very close, tight loop,
mm-hmm.
where latency of at a level of millisecond can really break the application, make the application behave incorrectly, or one example might be again that robotic arm that we were talking about last time, right? Mm-hmm. 1 millisecond latency might cause a glitch that, for example, turns the head that approaches the car or whatever mm-hmm. that robot creates at the wrong angle. Yeah. Hence, causing the entire production line to really fail. It would be kind of like a ripple effect, right? Yeah. Medical applications. Mm-hmm. You want the reliability, and you don't care that much of a throughput.
That's right? Correct.
So that's why those three levels have been introduced to satisfy the variety of needs around real time. And I think that the community did an excellent job here dividing those levels of preemptiveness or trade-off because, in fact, and that was part of reason why the real-time patch or the real-time implementation inside Linux kernel had such a difficulty getting into kernel mainline
mm-hmm.
was that a lot of engineers did not need real time, and they were just fine with whatever Linux kernel from kernel.org was delivering mm-hmm. because their application relied on throughput.
Yes.
So I think that the open source community did a fantastic job by simply implementing those mechanisms in such a way that you don't have to turn them on in the Linux kernel at all. So engineers that that really need throughput can still get the throughput exactly the way it was at the beginning in 2.6 Linux kernels. And engineers that do want real time or do want reliability can control the level of preemption, yeah. right? And that trade off. It's kind of like a little knob.
Yeah. Well, and by default too, it's set up for throughput. So I mean that's. You know, that's something where the average or regular, enterprise type user, it's not going to change their life that much. And so, hey, one of the things I wanted to mention is that I know last time we talked briefly about mutexes and spin locks, and I really got flamed because I did a very poor job of explaining the difference. And so, because one of the changes in the preemption patch, right, is the substitution in most cases, but not in all. Mm-hmm. Of spin locks for mutexes,
mm-hmm.
And anyway, so the first thing is when I talk about doing a spin lock, when I first heard the word spin lock, I had no idea what that meant because mm-hmm. I always
something spinning, right?
Yeah, like what's turning here, right? So but when you talk about a spin lock, what a spin lock means and is that it'll attempt to acquire a lock, right? So that means two things are contending for some resource, right? And or more than two, or some number of things are contending for a resource. And so when you set up a spin lock, it'll wait and continually retry until it can proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that when it's continually retrying, it won't yield to the scheduler until it's interrupted, mm-hmm. until that task is interrupted. And one of the benefits about using a spin lock is extremely fast to set up. I mean, they're very efficient, very, very, very efficient locking mechanisms with respect to speed. However, they're not very efficient with respect to predictability because it'll sit until it gets interrupted. And so the difference is a mutex, right? So a mutex will set itself up and then yield to the scheduler if it doesn't acquire its lock.
So let's back off a bit because I'm not sure if I got the part where we're talking about why spin locks are so bad for real-time app application?
Well, they're bad in the fact that they attempt to. So let's say you have two threads of execution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two programs, right? Your two threads that are attempting to both reach something, right? Some counter. So one of them will acquire a lock and begin doing its work, which might be, I don't know, 10 instructions long, but it's a computer, right? So 10 instructions. And the other one will also attempt to acquire the lock. And if it doesn't immediately get it, it'll retry and retry and retry and retry and retry. And it'll continue retrying until it's interrupted by the scheduler or it receives, well, I guess, and or it receives its lock, right? Because the other thing could be finished and then it can proceed. And that sort of activity means that there is a certain bit of time where that thread is really not doing anything, right? That activity, you know, the time that it's going through and waiting could be effectively yielded to another thread that can actually do something useful, right? Because in the time that it's spinning or waiting or retrying, probably a better way to say it is retrying. So in the time that it's retrying, you could potentially be running some other thread that will do something useful. And so that's why they're not preferable for a real-time system. Mm-hmm. So let's say this is a lower priority thread or something along those lines. It could potentially have yielded to a higher priority thread before the scheduler came through and changed things. Because remember, all processes are interrupted by the scheduling.
Right.
By scheduling interrupt. And I think I talked, you know, if you listen to this, but I think that's one of the miracles I found out when I started to, I know I've never worked on an operating system before, you know, mm-hmm. 5 years ago when I started this. And one of my big questions was, well, how does that scheduler ever get called, right? And so that timer interrupt, that interrupt that occurs for the scheduling to rehappen is every so often. Mm-hmm. And if you have a spin lock, you're sitting in a thread that could potentially have yielded to another process.
Mm-hmm.
And then the scheduler can do a better job of figuring out what to do next. So is that a good job?
I think you did excellent job.
Do you think I'm going to get flamed again?
But so now mutexes, right? The spin locks got substituted with mutexes. And what's different now?
So a mutex will say, okay. And a mutex is short for mutually exclusive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, if you've never unpacked that before. So what a mutex will do is it'll attempt to acquire a lock, and if it doesn't, it'll yield to the scheduler. And its loop, instead of saying retry, 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 it's try, fail, yield, right? Try, fail, yield. And whenever it does a yield, when it goes back to the scheduler and say do something, the scheduler can then go through and pick the task that needs to run next. And you're getting more scheduler calls in that sort of situation. But the flip of it is the advantage to that is the scheduler can then pick what really needs to run next, mm-hmm. which might not be your application. And that decision on whether to run the scheduler happens more frequently, so it can do a better job of picking the right thing to do next.
And I guess that another enhancement is that those new mutexes, they do have hooks for priority inheritance. So...
I was so focused on getting the, but no, that's entirely correct. So for priority inheritance, that means if that thread, right, happens to be blocking a resource needed by yet a higher priority thread, which is the classic priority inheritance problem, the scheduler will recognize that and then run that at the higher priority and schedule it through so that the even higher priority yet thread won't be waiting as long.
Right. So you get better preemption, but you get also better real-time behavior by implementing, by simply taking advantage of mutexes into system externals instead of spin locks.
Yeah. And so what they did is, to a great degree, they just went through and basically co-opted spin lock, but there's still, I think you can do, you can still do a raw spin lock. I mean, there are situations where you need that, right? So I think there's raw under spin lock, raw under bar spin lock, if you want the old spin lock, but the rest of them have been replaced. I know there's a couple places too, where they went in and said, oh, whoops, and they just replace with replace it with a raw spin lock instead of a mutex, because there are critical sections that must run in that fashion.
Okay, I think that we've exhausted that topic, at least in the time frame that we have. And before we actually finish, we have a few more topics that we should go through, I guess. So hard RQs executed in a threat context. And I think that we did talk about that concept last time. Mm-hmm. But the idea here is that in order to control better the reliability of real-time application threat, mm-hmm. The concept of moving the interrupt service routine into threat context has been introduced. Right.
So yes.
Mm-hmm. Right now, since interrupts, when they execute, they kind of execute outside of the scope of a scheduler. That means that none of the real-time threats, even quote-unquote, execute when a hard IRQ executes. Mm-hmm. To mitigate that effect, the interrupt service routine has been moved to a threat context where it's scheduled exactly the same way as other threats in the system, mm-hmm. and therefore end user can control the priorities and control to some extent the effect of arriving interrupts on a real-time application.
Yeah, correct. I mean, because it's one of those trade-offs where, I mean, even though you're getting, people aware of this, but tapping on the keyboard generates an interrupt. In fact, it generates a hardware interrupt that halts everything else so it can process that keystroke. Mm-hmm. And by being able to take the hardware interrupt scheduler and being able to put a priority on it, you can have a lot more control over the behavior of the computer. Of the system, rather, for events that are entirely external, mm-hmm. Because you may not have control over something like the traffic coming off the network card. Depending upon how your network is configured, sometimes you can get a lot of traffic on your network card that the kernel will get and it has to do something with. And it's a way for you to insulate your system against these external events.
And this particular implementation does influence the ratio of throughput versus
throughput versus what is it? Predictability.
Thank you, Gene. That's it. I was just looking at my notes. I'm like, wow, I jumped already to another concept. And the next concept I want to talk about, because I'm looking at our time here, is the high resolution timers implementation. So the latest addition to a Linux kernel that got into a Linux kernel mainline with the release of a 2.6.21 kernel.
And they're actually really important, right? It's mm-hmm. very important that you have access to your hardware clock, because that gets you predictability with respect to how your system behaves. And I know even inside your little Pentium machine there actually is a high-resolution, microsecond timer that really isn't available or wasn't available before in prior versions of Linux. And I know for different vendors we have, different board vendors TimeSys works with, they'll also put a high-res timer on their card that before was totally ignored by the operating system.
Well, so what that means is that POSIX timers and nanosleep calls can be as accurate as hardware allows, right?
Yes.
And usually that's the level of single microseconds, mm-hmm. which means that the entire time management inside Linux kernel gets improved, gets to that level of microseconds, and you can schedule timers, timer interrupts, for example, mm-hmm. At that granularity.
Yeah, I know one of the tests that we have here, right, when we benchmark things, is we set up a sleep for some short amount of time, right, and then see how much time passed when the timer finally wakes up, and then we run a bunch of those and see what happens. And it's interesting. And we talked before about sort of the POSIX behavior mm-hmm. for Linux. And before you could set up an anti-sleep, and you could set it for 3 microseconds and 5 microseconds, and never get called. Right?
Exactly.
Time would pass, and eventually these operating systems would get around to...
Yeah, time management was not that great yet.
Yeah, and so what's really cool now is you can run the same same sort of program, same program, and your call will actually get executed, or your timer will actually get woken up when you ask for it, or reasonably so. And so the latency there is drastically decreased. I guess there's two things actually. There's one is the accuracy. Right? Mm-hmm. This is an accuracy issue because before it simply wouldn't do that, right? And then the latency is also greatly reduced as well.
Right.
And a lot of the real time behavior really depends on having an accurate clock.
Absolutely.
And not only an accurate clock, but a predictably accurate clock and a fine grained one as well. So.
Okay. So before we actually come to an end of today's episode, I wanted to mention two configuration options that have been introduced into 6 Linux kernels.
Sure.
We talked a bit about the fact that Linux users have final control over the Linux kernel configuration. They can fine-tune the performance by turning that knob, throughput versus reliability of the mm-hmm. Linux kernel. But there are also some of the configuration options under debugging, or I think debugging, that allow... that allow the tracing of information as to what's the latency, what's the wake-up timing.
Mm-hmm.
And the two options I wanted to mention specifically here is a config latency trace, which really allows end user to track the full trace of the maximum latency. And this is kind of like a text file that... has a number of information points,
okay.
Meaning there's a time that it's spent in a specific timing event, followed by a specific call or what happened at that time, mm-hmm. and you can really track where you spend your time in the
yeah.
application
uh-huh.
or in your system mm-hmm. per se. The second option is config wake up timing. Which allows the tracking of maximum recorded time between waking up of a high priority task and its scheduling on a CPU.
Okay,
and that's shown in microseconds.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about those options is that you can track them through proc file system.
Oh, okay,
and
everyone loves that.
Yes, I love that. Concept, in Linux kernel, and you can also reset a lot of those values through a proc file system by simply writing to a specific proc file system file.
So you can actually do some verification of your system without having to instrument your code, right?
Exactly.
That's wonderful, right? Who likes to do that?
Rather than running some of the benchmarks, if you can afford to have those options turned on, you mm-hmm. can track latency and timings in real time. The trade-off here is that the latency trace increases overhead. So your kernel most likely would result in a larger footprint. The performance, the throughput might get even worse, because additional code is really being executed in a control path.
Right? Yeah. Well, it's the same thing, Machi, right? I mean, it's like the basic quantum effect, right?
Yeah.
but I mean, the flip is that you'd much rather have it there than your code instrumented. Because even if you instrumented, you'd still run across the same sort of issues. It's like six of one, half dozen of the other. If you're getting the right information you need, you can always set up a different kernel.
Okay, so just to recap what we talked about today and what's new in a 2.6 Linux kernel. O1 scheduler, improved POSIX implementation, number of levels of... preemption, voluntary preemption, preemptible kernel, and full real-time preemption. Hard IRQs are executed in the thread context. The priority inheritance is right now available on both kernel and user space mutexes, and the high-resolution timers have been, which is the latest addition to a Linux kernel, to a 2.6 Linux kernel. And plus, at the end, we talked about various configuration options that that you can turn on and have them as default options in your kernel.
Yeah. I know we're going time ways way over, but I did want to mention, we did get one of the interesting emails we got from the last time. It came from Jacob, and he sent a chapter to a book he mm-hmm. wrote about real time and predictability and behavior. And of course, this is an experienced real time guy, right? And mm-hmm. so he typically worked with operating systems that were specialized to be hard real time operating systems. And I think rises in pain whenever he has to look at what Linux does, because it is soft real time. Mm-hmm. He brought up some interesting points about if you're going to design something that's going to be real time, you have to do it from the first line of code that you write. Otherwise, you can really put yourself into a pickle. And it's interesting the chapter of the book he wrote talked about finding worst case and calculating worst case scenario for code. And it really is, it's a worthwhile topic. I know one of the things we wanted to talk about next is, what happens in user land. That's more my bailiwick for real time. Of course, if you don't have the primitives in the kernel, it doesn't matter what happens in user land, right? But there is a great body of knowledge out there with respect to doing static analysis and dynamic analysis on your code to see the latencies and to calculate your worst case scenario, because that's really what real time is about, right? It's making sure you always meet your worst case deadline and make sure you bound all your latencies, which mm-hmm. I think is mm-hmm. necessary to meeting all your deadlines.
Yeah, so that was actually a great point. When I was reading that email, one thing that jumped at me was that Jacob actually said that in his email that Linux is not really hard real time. And I just want to make that obvious again that this is really soft real time operating system, where you can't guarantee the worst case latency mm-hmm. For your application, and there are other OSs that can probably probably do a better job. I don't. I'm not sure if they can guarantee the worst case latency. Mm-hmm. I have limited experience with a number of them. I'm sure that they can do a better job. I'm not sure how well they can guarantee that that worst case scenario will be achieved across certain specific period of time.
Well, you get into the same sort of issues, right? You're going to make trade-offs against throughput. You're going to make trade-offs against hardware support. You're going to make right. You're going to make if you get a real hard time, a real-time operating system that is hard real-time. Mm-hmm. Those only run on a limited number of processors because of all the work they have to do in order to catch all those latency issues.
Well, but even if you do the source code audit, even if you analyze all the execution paths, there's another aspect, which is a timing aspect to the execution, which is that given your application, you might... And what it's doing in time, it's possible that when you implement it, you deploy it in a field. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, after a few weeks of running, or even few months of running, it just does something bad, mm-hmm. something that you haven't encountered for, because you were not able to run a QA for that long under those specific timing conditions, and sometimes just analysis of code is not sufficient.
Oh yeah, I mean I agree there, because you do get into situations where, and I think we mentioned it before, it's like the best software in the world won't make a bad programmer better, right? And so even if you have a system that's designed to be hard real time from the first line that was ever written, if you're a bad engineer, I'm certain you can screw that up, but I guess I just want to say, to say thanks to Jake, because he did spend a lot of time to write to us. And, it was really interesting. And the chapter out of the book was great. I mean,
I enjoyed reading it. So on that note, a message to you, our listeners, please do let us know what interests you. Do let us know what you would like us to talk about. Explore some of the concepts, ideas of the Linux kernel. We are very much interested in your feedback.
Yeah, it really helps. So, because we do get a decent amount of feedback for every episode, and we can't always guarantee we're right back, but we try. Mm. And it's really interesting because it really helps us focus in and talk about things and describe clearer some things that we didn't do very good the last time around, or mm-hmm. still aren't obvious, or new concepts to the audience. And so if you have any questions or comments, you feel free to drop us an email at podcast@timesys.com. I think the guys over in marketing have fixed the podcast page to put the email on it, because they redid the you know how they always fiddle with stuff. So they redid the page, and I think they took off the email address. So
That was an omission, I guess.
Yeah. So I mean, the last time we got a couple emails from guys that said, you know, be easier if you put the email address. So but it's on there. If just, you know, if you look at our podcast page, or if you want to drop us a line at podcast@timesys.com, we'll be more than happy to.
Absolutely. And I hope that you've enjoyed ours today's podcast and concepts that we have talked about. And not sure if we'll come back to real time topics next time, but we'll take a look at what's on our list and we'll definitely let you know.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux or looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.